Good morning. So liberal traditions have a profound, liberal religions have a profound tradition of speaking out against injustice. 2,000 years ago, a radical, nonviolent revolutionary spoke out against wealthy Nazarenes, advocated for the poor, and rallied against corrupt, powerful religious leaders. Margaret Fuller, born in 1810 in the midst of the New England Transcendentalists, was not permitted to go to Harvard Divinity School like her well-known Universalist peers, Ralph Waldo Emerson, William Ellery Channing, and Theodore Parker. She persisted in getting an education on her own and started a meeting place in Peabody's bookshop in Boston where women could discuss ethics, art, education, and theology. Her book, Women of the 19th Century, encapsulated the work of this group and was termed by Horace Greeley the loftiest and most commanding assertion yet of the rights of women. In March of 1965, 45 UU ministers and 15 UU lay people answered Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s call to march in Selma, Alabama. Blood was spilled, which resulted in the deaths of African-American activist Jimmy Lee Jackson and two white UUs, Viola Liuzzo and James Reeb. Viola Liuzzo, telling her husband why she had to go, said, "It's everybody's fight. There are too many people just standing around talking." That week, President Lyndon Johnson introduced to Congress the landmark Voting Rights Act. It's not just these historical figures that have put their values in practice against hate and injustice. Many of us, for sure, can tell of friends, family, doing the same thing in small but important and courageous ways. So, that's a glimpse of history. What about now? What obligation do we have now, today, this morning, to continue this proud tradition to act and speak out as you use based on our values? Right after the 2016 election, our social justice chair, whom I happen to be married to, at WOLF, initiated a monthly list of local actions we could take in support of social justice. This was dubbed Now More Than Ever. I'm going to paint a picture of why it is critical, a critical time for us to speak out and act on our values as liberal religious people now more than ever. Pulpit Freedom Sunday. Sounds like it might be a sermon given on, I don't know, Independence Day. It's not. On Sunday, October 2nd, 2008, 35 pastors across the country told their congregations for whom they should vote. This was done purposely as a challenge to federal tax law, the Johnson Amendment, that prohibits tax-exempt organizations from engaging in partisan political activity. By 2014, Public Freedom Sunday grew to 1,800 pastors. This movement is continuing, and it's getting bolder. Under the leadership of an organization called the Alliance Defending Freedom, this same organization works to develop religious liberty that will allow the denial of goods and services to GLBTQ people based on religion. The same organization. Trump may not know his Bible well, but he sees this as a way to the hearts of the Christian right, promising to destroy the Johnson Amendment. The latest political development is that recently the U.S. House passed a funding bill that prevents the revocation of tax-exempt status for organizations that back political candidates. It's unlikely to pass the Senate, but this too is backed by Alliance for Defending Freedom, who wrote a letter of support to Senate leadership in support of this bill, claiming to represent 4,000 religious leaders. So, The Christian right has become increasingly bold, politically, even to the extent of practicing civil disobedience. I thought that's what the left did. Civil disobedience from the pulpit. Now more than ever, we cannot cede this ground. In fact, we have ground to recover, and we must be less cautious. Now more than ever, we must speak and act and teach boldly in ways that reflect our values. The election of Donald Trump, his campaign rhetoric, and continued tweets has emboldened hate speech and has emboldened hate organizations. His refusal to denounce neo-Nazis, white supremacists at Charlottesville might have been the most blatant, but was just one of many such occurrences. Retweeting white supremacist messages encouraged violence against black protesters, rallies, appointing some of the most rabid voices against Muslims to his team. The number of hate groups have grown significantly since the 2016 election. Anti-Muslim hate groups alone in the U.S. have grown from 34 in 2015 to 101 last year, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. And right here in Oregon, the group Oregonians for Immigrant Reform, a group also classified as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, has succeeded in getting that measure on the November ballot that would repeal our 30-year-old sanctuary law. You'll hear more about this later in the service and continuing the coffee hour. We do have a proud tradition of speaking out and acting based on our values. Now more than ever, we need to boldly increase our voice and our hands.
What stops us from speaking up? What keeps us from claiming our place as people of faith in the public sphere? I want to speak about two such barriers today. As people of a liberal religious faith with no creed, sometimes it can be hard for us to judge or reject. Maybe we have been judged or rejected ourselves. It's true that our third principle calls us to acceptance of one another, and our fifth principle calls us to respect the right of conscience. But our principles also call us to honor the inherent worth and dignity of every individual, including those that belong to marginalized groups, and to work for peace, liberty, and justice for all. We must remember that our fourth principle calls not just for a free search for truth and meaning, but a free and responsible one. Sometimes we have to draw lines. Sometimes siding with love and justice means we say no. One of the few things we can't accept if we truly value democracy and peaceful coexistence is bigotry in action. Philosopher Karl Popper called this the paradox of tolerance. He argued that unlimited tolerance can all too easily lead to the downfall of tolerance itself. When we extend our tolerance to those who are openly intolerant, who publicly call for the persecution of others, eventually the tolerant ones end up being destroyed, and tolerance along with them. He wrote, "We should consider incitement to intolerance and persecution as criminal in the same way as we should consider incitement to murder or to kidnapping or to the revival of the slave trade as criminal." Even John Rawls, one of the fiercest advocates for freedom in 20th century philosophy, wrote that societies are justified in restricting intolerant or bigoted groups when the tolerant sincerely and with reason believe that their own security and the institutions of liberty are in danger. I can think of no better description of our current situation than that our security and the institutions of liberty, from voting rights to due process to religious liberty to the Supreme Court, are in danger from those who want the promises of this country to apply only to them. As President Franklin Roosevelt said in another time of moral crisis, we are a nation of many nationalities, many races, many religions, bound together by a single unity, the unity of freedom and equality. Whoever seeks to set one nationality against another seeks to degrade all nationalities. Whoever seeks to set one race against another seeks to enslave all races. Whoever seeks to set one religion against another seeks to destroy all religion. Our UU principles in history teach us to honor and stand for that unity of freedom and equality. Another barrier to our speaking out is that often we don't like conflict. We don't like anger. It makes us uncomfortable. Maybe sometimes we feel trapped between the rage of the right-wing extremists and the righteous anger of those suffering under their oppression. Immigrants, people of color, disabled people, poor people, LGBTQ people, those who follow a faith other than Christianity or no faith at all. Maybe we're afraid of our own anger. There's so much to be angry about these days. It's understandable that maybe we're afraid that if we let ourselves feel that anger, it will never stop. It will take us over and burn us down, burn us out. So it is tempting to resolve our discomfort by calling for civility, for everyone to be less angry. But to do so is to draw a false equivalence between the destructive extremist rage that is right now tearing our country apart and the constructive anger that is the fuel of every civil rights movement. Often our language around emotions is imprecise, but I believe strongly that now is a time to be very careful to draw a distinction between anger and rage. Rage is violent, overpowering, out of control. It consumes and destroys. All of us in the U.S. and many around the world are suffering right now because of the destructive rage that leads many with privilege, often straight cis white people, to dehumanize and devalue everyone not like them in retribution for the loss of privilege, of dominance that was never rightly theirs to begin with. Anger is different. Anger is about the distance between what can be, what should be, and what is, measured in longing and need, and it can be powerful fuel. Black lesbian philosopher and poet Audre Lorde wrote, "Anger expressed and translated into action in the service of our vision and our future is a liberating and strengthening act of clarification. For it is in the painful process of this translation that we identify who are our allies with whom we have grave differences and who are our genuine enemies." Anger is loaded with information and energy. Anger is a grief of distortions between peers, and its object is change. When our civil society and the rights and protections we all deserve, which so many have fought and died for, are under attack, anger is an appropriate response. It means we value the promises made in the Constitution, the promises we make to each other as members of a shared society, and we are willing to stand up for those promises. When those of us who are actively endangered by a right-wing extremism fight back against their barrage of assaults on our humanity, our anger is an appropriate response. It means that despite their cruelty, we have learned to value ourselves enough to demand dignity and respect. Progressive Presbyterian minister Jim Rigby recently wrote, "In my opinion, the word civility does not refer to politeness. It refers to the virtues that make a common humanity possible in the first place. Whatever we do, it is important, whenever possible, not to sink to the same level as the mindless cruelty we oppose. Somehow we must remember the hopes we have for the kind of world we want to live in. To me, civility is acting out of that hope for a world that might be better for everyone." Earlier this summer, after several Trump administration officials were publicly called out for the horrible acts they either committed or defended, feminist thinker and activist Jessica Valenti wrote, "One of the foundational parts of building a community is drawing boundaries about what is considered acceptable and unacceptable behavior. It's normal for people to decide that certain actions have no place in a civil society. What is happening to Republicans right now is just that. Community members sending a clear message about what they're willing to tolerate and what none of us should have to. There's nothing more civil than that. And it's important to remember, when we speak out, we're not always speaking to persuade those who disagree with us. Sometimes we speak out to show solidarity with those under attack, to show them that there is more than just hatred here. There's also support and compassion. And when we don't speak out, we leave our allies standing alone. We live in difficult times. The relentless stream of outrage committed by the Trump administration and their accomplices in Congress and elsewhere is exhausting. It is vital that we be patient, kind, and in solidarity with each other, and just as vital that we resist the bigotry and hatred that is truly responsible for making our society uncivil with all of the strength, creativity, anger, and love we can muster. Extremists who wrap themselves in the flag and clutch the Bible while their actions betray the Constitution and their own Messiah's call for loving our neighbors as we do ourselves have usurped our country. They publicly claim to be values voters and the moral majority, as though their values are the only ones, as though everyone else is less moral. We can be bolder in speaking our truths. We can be more spirited in asserting our place in this country as people of progressive values. Because our values, human dignity, justice, equity, compassion, acceptance, truth, respect, community, the balance of interdependence and individual rights, peace, liberty, and justice for all, are American values. Our values are the ones that truly support a free democratic society. And in these terrible, disheartening days, in this time of moral crisis, now more than ever, it is a time for us to be bold and let our anger give us energy to put those values into action.
So now it's all hands to value stations. I want to talk about the ways we can all transform our UU values into actions. You remember us talking about IP 22? It was a ballot proposal. Now it has gotten enough signatures and it is on the ballot. It's called Measure 105. It's a proposal. If approved, it will repeal Oregon's first in the nation 30-year-old sanctuary law, a law which was enacted in the wake of a wave of racial profiling and immigration raids in the 80s in Oregon. The original law simply states that no Oregon law enforcement agency shall use their money, equipment, or personnel to detect or apprehend people whose only violation of the law is that they are undocumented immigrants. In our present political climate particularly, the repeal of this law could be devastating to friends, neighbors, and for some even families. Every day we hear more and more stories of long-term residents being sent to a country they don't know, immigrant families being torn apart, ICE raids, and children being detained in immigration camps. Throwing out our sanctuary law would turn our local law enforcement into another arm of the current administration's deportation force. As Jack mentioned, the driving force behind Measure 105 is an organization called OFER, Oregonians for Immigration Reform. Sounds good, but it's been labeled an extremist hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. If you have any more questions or comments, we'll all be downstairs at the social justice table at coffee hour so we can talk more. And we can also help you choose actions then that you can take to live your values. One of our major actions, we have 30 vote no on 105 posters downstairs. And we're looking for people to take some to their neighborhood small businesses and ask them to post it in their windows. We also have a pledge form that we're asking the businesses to sign. We can supply you with two or three posters, pledge forms, an information flyer, and a script. Jack and I did this in our neighborhood last weekend, and it's really surprisingly easy to do. Everyone we talked to was supportive. Most people signed the pledge even if they weren't comfortable with putting the poster up. In some cases, like if you go into a Starbucks, they have a company policy not to post political issues. So, you know, they were understanding, but they would always at least sign the pledge. And you know what? Seeing that poster in the window and knowing it's there because of you really makes you feel good. Other things you can do would be to sign the pledge yourself. The easiest way is to go to orunited.org and do it electronically, or recruit three people to sign it, or write a letter to your local paper. In the near future, both Emerge, our interfaith movement for immigrant justice organization that WERF belongs to, and the UUA are writing editorial pieces against 105 to be published in the Voters Guide. In order to be included, it's required either to pay $1,200 or get 500 signatures. So soon, hopefully next week, we will have both of these petitions available for you to sign. Finally, we have an activity for you. It's a way to frame what we've been talking about and to make it more personal for you. If you look in your order of service, you find something that's a little bit unusual. You have an insert. If we open the insert, you'll see there's two pairs of hands. The one on the left is the hand of fellowship, and the one on the right is the hand of action. So take a few minutes. We have a box of pens and pencils here if you don't have a pen or pencil with you. On the left hand, write a statement of fellowship to those potentially affected by Measure 105, or you resolve to take action, whatever you're feeling at the moment. On the right hand, write one or two actions that you will commit to doing to protect our fellow Oregonians. There are suggestions of actions you might consider on the reverse of the left hand. Of the right hand. Then rip the two hands apart. We'll collect the left hand of fellowship on your way out and we'll display them all downstairs. That will be your statement of solidarity with immigrants or resolve to take action. The right hand of action, the actions that you choose to do, is for you to take home with you to remember your resolve. Thank you, and we look forward to seeing you downstairs for more discussions and actions.
Thank you again to the social justice team for a provocative and, I hope, helpful prescription for acting.